I'm really glad and thrilled to have you with us. It's an honor to talk to you. You've been quite an inspirational force in the world of nutrition, of which both of us have been aware of your work. Tucker Goodrich has known about your work longer than myself, but I've been fascinated by the insights, the little bit that I've learned so far. Tucker, would you provide a little background for yourself?
Me?
Yeah.
I studied mostly humanities and arts for the first 10 years or so after I graduated from college. And just because of seeing how many things were being mismanaged in science and health, I decided to go back to graduate school and get a PhD in biology, physiology. And so I went right from literature and painting into physiology and got PhD at University of Oregon at 1972. And since then, I've been working on related themes between brain function. I got that was my actual first interest in graduate school, but I discovered that the nerve biology and brain biology people were extremely dogmatic. And so I looked around the biology department and I found that the physiologists, and especially the reproductive physiologists, were actually scientific rather than dogmatic. And so I concentrated on age-related changes in fertility in females in particular. And that turned out to be very valuable for understanding the brain, which had been my first orientation. The female hormones, actually progesterone, is a basic stabilizing factor. It's historically considered a pregnancy hormone, but it's essential for brain function in both men and women. And the concentration in the brain of progesterone is about 10 times higher than in the blood. So that has been one of my main orientations the last almost 50 years, is looking at the implications of progesterone deficiency. And along with that, stress induces estrogen, which again isn't the female hormone as it's been advertised now for about 70 years. It's actually a stress hormone. If a man is injured or has a heart attack or is very sick and old, his estrogen is going to be as high as a woman's or higher. So it's a stress and aging indicator or hormone, not definitely not a fertility hormone. In the 1930s, estrogen was already identified as a promoter of miscarriage or abortion and inflammation and cancer. Despite that, the estrogen industry by the early 1940s discovered that almost anything toxic turns out to have an estrogenic effect. Soot, for example, you can extract about 1,000 different estrogenic substances from soot. So the industry found a very cheap, almost so cheap you could hardly identify a cost, substance which is estrogenic, and began selling it as the female fertility, pregnancy protecting hormone, estrogen, convinced the FDA and other regulatory agencies that it was an appropriate treatment for pregnant women, aging women to prevent aging and so on. The first 200 ailments or more that estrogen was sold to treat all turned out to be fraudulent. But they made many billions of dollars in the process. So they changed medical schools, medical journals, the whole national consciousness to sell their fraudulent scheme or project.
Well, it's good. It's good to hear that not much has changed in the last many decades.
Yeah.
Dr. Pete, how did you take this interest into the nutrition sphere?
While I was still working in the humanities, I started a school in Mexico called Blake College in the early 1960s. And I started seeing, for example, students who would come after work just couldn't learn anything. And so I started giving them a wheat germ and egg, a biscuit, and a coffee with a little vitamin B1 added. And they became good students. Just a few good meals, and their brains were functioning better. Then a friend mentioned that his niece was dying in the hospital of intractable diarrhea. And I told him what I had read in Adele Davis's book, written in the late 1950s, about vitamin B6. Sometimes curing diarrhea. And after two or three days, he finally consented. He said they had given up and that she was probably going to die within a day or so. So he went over the doctor's heads and gave the kid 10 milligrams of vitamin B6. And within hours, her diarrhea had stopped, and she was out of the hospital within a few days. That was one of the deciding things that made me realize how powerful nutritional therapies could be.
Indeed. That sounds somewhat similar to my own experience, where I was able to put an inflammatory bowel disease that I'd suffered from for 16 years in remission in a couple of days by cutting back on my polyunsaturated fat intake. I was rather surprised at how effective it was, and that spurred my own interest in nutrition and your research, among other things. So thank you, by the way, for all the papers that you've published in there, you know, on your, or the blog posts that you've done over the years. I've started reading them probably more than 10 years ago, and I find that every time, as I continue to learn, I go back and I reread them and appreciate how much you had said that I wasn't able to understand the first times because I didn't have the background to comprehend the points that you were making. So you've become, I don't want to say notorious, but rather famous in nutrition circles for having a somewhat unconventional view of what a healthy human diet looks like. How would you describe, for somebody who's new to your work, how would you describe, you know, succinctly your views on what human nutrition should be optimally?
I started out in Mexico looking at the reason for malnutrition, and poverty was a major thing. So I started thinking about the cost of foods and what was most easily available, and started looking around the health of populations around the world and what they were eating and what was economically available to correct their problems. I saw that refined grains, for example, seemed to be a major problem when the traditional Mexican diet of tortillas and vegetables small amounts of crustaceans, when that diet was replaced by the Spanish refined cereal-based diet and meats, for example, the nutritional deficiency diseases started showing up. So I looked at what the traditional diets were doing, and the lime processing using either calcium hydroxide or sodium hydroxide from ashes to soak the corn kernels in, to pre-cook them in this strong alkali solution. It changes the chemistry. For example, decreases the tryptophan, turns it into niacin, makes the starch and toxic proteins digestible and harmless. So simply their traditional process of the way they cooked their corn turned it from a toxin to an actually a beneficial food rich in calcium and niacin and other essential nutrients, rather than in the southern U.S., where they imported corn from Mexico but didn't widely use the alkali process. The hominy is the safe form of corn cooked in lime. But when they didn't make their corn into hominy, they got pellagra.
Yes.
Terrible.
A very nasty disease of niacin deficiency. Niacin is vitamin B6, if I remember correctly.
With an excess of leucine, one of the excess amino acids in corn.
Right. Yes, interesting, interesting. How did you... Okay, so that makes sense. I mean, that's a pretty, you know... I hate to say it, you know, it seems that when you go to a vet, the first thing they ask you about your pet is, what is your pet eating? And when you go to a doctor, they don't generally ask that question. Or biological approach. If you have nutritional deficiencies, let's figure out what's causing them. So,
I used to suggest that people would do better going to their vet rather than their doctor.
Yes, exactly. What? So what were? So you make a couple of statements that a lot of people find somewhat confusing or hard to take. You're a fan of, to some extent, of consuming sugar as part of a healthy diet. Do you want to describe the rationale behind that?
Many years ago, I was hearing dietitians talk about the glycemic index of foods, and right in their own tables, they showed that starches had a higher glycemic index than sucrose. And that started me thinking about the difference between starch and sucrose. Sucrose consists of 50% fructose and 50% glucose, where starch is, when you assimilate it, it's pure glucose.
Right.
And glucose stimulates insulin, turning on fat production and lowering your blood glucose, unless you have a steady intake of it, where the fructose component either doesn't stimulate insulin or even can have a restraining influence on insulin. And so intrinsically, the reason sugar has a lower glycemic index than starch is that the fructose component restricts insulin and restrains fat synthesis, and so stabilizes blood sugar.
For just that, was advocated as a better sweetener for diabetics for a while.
But it has to be, unless you extract it from ripe Jerusalem artichokes, which take a lot of care in storage and so on, it's generally manufactured chemically. And so it turns out that quite a few people have an allergic type reaction to the manufactured form of fructose. But if you eat fruits, for example, you not only get the fructose component of the sucrose, but the high potassium content of the fruit has an insulin-like activity that also restrains your body's production of insulin. So the fruit goes in with a slightly insulin moderating fructose content, and also the simultaneously the potassium, which takes care of absorbing the glucose without needing to secrete insulin. And so it has these surprising ways of bypassing the insulin problem or what's related to diabetes. And I ran across two 19th century doctors, one in Paris and one in following up in England, who the one in Paris was the first to observe that a high sugar diet cured his terminal diabetic patients. Originally diabetes, because you couldn't assimilate glucose, you turned your protein of your tissues into glucose to survive. And so the diabetic wasted away, lost their muscles, and finally died in essentially a starvation condition. The doctor in France gave his terminal diabetic patients who were wasting away the amount of sugar they craved, and found that they stopped wasting away and very quickly started building muscle when they were eating a regular diet, milk, beef, fruits and vegetables, and so on, but along with a sugar supplement. So the doctor in England did exactly the same thing and described the course of people who were dying, wasting away, putting out tremendous amounts of sugar in their urine, even though they weren't eating any. They were restricted because they called diabetes the sugar disease. So they were torturing their patients by not letting them have any of the sugar that they craved. But he decided not to torture his patients and let them add as much sugar as they wanted to their diet. Suddenly they stopped putting glucose into their urine and stopped losing muscle and recovered very quickly.
And so it sounds like this was because the sugar intake was sparing the liver the necessity of using glucose to produce the glucose that their bodies needed.
It turns off the cortisol, which breaks down your tissue protein to make sugar out of it, or the sugar equivalent. Same thing happens in cancer. The myth has developed that sugar feeds cancer, it's true in a sense, but the cancer sends out signals such as ammonia to the body that it needs sugar if you don't have sugar in your diet. And the body turns on extreme amounts of cortisol, providing sugar by breaking down your immune system and muscles and skin, all of your tissues, except the brain and lungs and heart are preserved. But the cancer causes cachexia, or the wasting disease, as the main killer. And if you simply give the body a large amount of glucose or sugar of any sort, that will reduce the production of cortisol and stop the destruction of the body tissue, or at least slow it. So diabetes and cancer have that in common, that they involve the stress, high cortisol induced loss of active body tissue to provide the glucose, which is essential for the brain to survive.
Are both diabetes and cancer driven a lot by the overconsumption of the PUFAs?
Exactly. The PUFA, the number of unsaturated groups in the molecule, the more highly polyunsaturated the fat is, the more double bonds there are in the molecule. And exactly in proportion to the number of double bonds, the interference with thyroid function increases. So the enzymes that release thyroid from the gland are inhibited by the highly unsaturated fatty acids. The proteins that carry thyroid hormone in the blood, the thyroid is displaced competitively by the highly unsaturated fatty acids, exactly in proportion to the number of double bonds. And the cells, tissue cells' ability to respond to the thyroid hormone that they do receive is blocked in proportion to the number of double bonds. So it's every known step of thyroid activity which is needed to produce oxidative energy, and it's that exactly which fails in diabetes and cancer. So you lose oxidative energy production from glucose, and the fatty acids, it's in the 1960s, research showed that as your free fatty acids in the blood go up from stress, from the need for more sugar in your diet, the increase of free fatty acids blocks exactly the ability to use and oxidize glucose. Apparently, the basic survival function of that, which is called the Randall cycle, the biological function is probably to stop the use of glucose in your massive skeletal muscles and dispensable tissues, skin and muscles in particular, saving whatever glucose is available for use by the brain, heart, and lungs. But as the free fatty acids in the blood rise, then even the ability of the heart and lungs and brain to use glucose for energy decreases. And that's especially true if the free fatty acids are highly unsaturated, because they are increasingly toxic to the mitochondria in proportion to their instability and high unsaturation.
Okay. Now this, reminds me of one of your blog posts, Dr. Pete, that's of information, and there's a lot of unpacking that can be done to understand some of the things. Your comments, to go back to your comments on sugar, there are primitive tribes that subsist on high amounts of honey, which is effectively the same thing as sugar, up to 80% seasonally in some groups, and to suffer no ill effects, which speaks to your view that sugar isn't, except for perhaps for its dental effects, a harmful nutrient. There's organization, I will say, of fructose going on nowadays. There's a physician out of San Francisco, Dr. Lustig, I don't know if you're aware of him, who's done...
Yeah. I saw his famous video.
Right. Okay. Do you have any thoughts on what the difference between your view and his view on fructose and metabolism?
During his talk in that video, he quickly shows many references in the background. And I looked up all of the references that I could read and found that they supported my argument as much as they did his. And for example, he described fructose as a poison similar to ethyl alcohol. And in fact, if you're poisoned by an overdose of ethanol, if you're very, very drunk, the antitoxin or the antidote to alcohol poisoning is fructose. It exactly reverses the changes inside the cells caused by alcohol. So where he was right about alcohol being a metabolic poison, he was exactly wrong by saying it's like fructose. Fructose is the antidote to the alcohol effect.
That's fascinating, and that is very interesting.
Tucker, I wanted to ask, you know, what he mentioned about the role of PUFAs in causing cancer, is that related to kind of what you've proposed about cardiolipin and its role? Could you explain that, or maybe
Dr. PUFA seems to be a metabolic, a mitochondrial toxin to the effect that, I mean, there's some argument that your mitochondria actually prefer to burn it to get rid of it. It seems to be toxic to the extent that it alters the mitochondrial composition, which makes it more susceptible to oxidative damage, and this breaks down the electron transport chain, impairing mitochondrial function, especially the ability to process glucose. So, you know, if that's basically the mechanism that I've seen that describes what Dr. Pete is talking about.
It used to be 40 or 50 years ago, there was the absolute dogma that diabetes was a genetic disease, almost 100% caused by genes. New immigrants after the formation of Israel. Israel had an extremely high incidence of diabetes, somewhat higher than the European countries the immigrants had come from. And dogma persisted that they simply had the genes for being diabetic. But then immigrants to Israel from the African countries, these people were very genetically different and had no diabetes at all when they moved into the new country, but they soon took up the European diet that the diabetics were eating, and their children all had the European high incidence of diabetes, totally disproving the genetic causation, and the polyunsaturated fats were high in the European diet and had been very low in the African immigrants until they moved.
So do you see any promising treatments people are proposing for diabetes and cancer, or is that a complicated?
Yeah, the same as the two 19th century doctors. It's all a matter of revising your thinking, realizing that the unsaturated fats are the cause, and getting rid of them in the diet as far as possible, and then returning to a more traditional diet of carbohydrates and moderate amounts of protein from a variety of sources.
Right, and that's, sorry, go ahead, David.
I was just saying, let food be thy medicine is your approach for these diseases, right?
And the minerals are extremely important in a less refined diet. There was a lot of magnesium and calcium. Vegetable greens, if they're cooked, provide both lots of magnesium and calcium. And the cows and goats that live primarily on leafy greens process their rumen, ferments, and predigests the greens, which are high in PUFA, but they the bacteria in their rumen destroys about 97% of the PUFA, so you get the very rich calcium and magnesium content in their milk, and to some extent in the meat, but not nearly as much as in the milk, along with a radical decrease of the PUFA content. Simply getting a very generous amount of these minerals, calcium and magnesium, is therapeutic not only to diabetes, but to a lot of other conditions. There's a somewhat mysterious brain disease that was first seen in Guam, but in several other regions, that resembles Lou Gehrig's disease or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, and Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease. It includes a combination of all of those symptoms. And they have considered various theories about poisons from bacteria and so on, and from eating a flying fox that had lived on foods containing those bacteria. And it turns out that what those regions have in common, not the toxins, but they are all regions very low in calcium and or magnesium. And in the absence of a large amount of calcium or magnesium in your diet, the brain cells take up any positively charged metal in place of the calcium and magnesium. What happens when you're deficient in calcium is your parathyroid gland becomes hyperactive, turns off almost directly or indirectly your mitochondrial function, decreases your ability to produce energy, and lacking energy, cells tend to calcify, and the calcium is in early years protective of these de-energized, devitalized tissues. But if it continues for a long time, the diet deficiency of calcium leading to hyperparathyroidism and reduced mitochondrial energy leads to eventually destructive levels of calcium in the tissues, such as hardening of the arteries, calcification of the brain, heart valves, kidneys, and so on. But in these island regions, they called it Guamanian dementia because it was discovered on the island of Guam. In the absence of the calcium to such an extent that your parathyroid hormone becomes very high, de-energizing your cells, if your environment has a normal amount of iron, lead, and any of the heavy metals, they will load up to a toxic extent with the heavy metals. And then the heavy metals interact to catalyze the oxidative breakdown of the PUFA, which are concentrated in the brain. So a calcium deficiency, if you're extremely deficient, you won't even deposit the usual amount of calcium. It'll be replaced by iron deposits or lead or whatever other metal is excessive. Copper, molybdenum, and manganese, for example, or and aluminum. Aluminum is a major accumulated mineral because it's generally abundant when calcium is deficient.
Interesting. So now you mentioned at one point in our discussion how high fatty acids can impair insulin, and there's been, obviously, as I'm sure you're well aware, ketogenic diets have become quite popular outside of the therapeutic indications in the last few years. Some people have used your writings to say that a ketogenic diet can be harmful because the lack of glucose increases cortisol to meet the body's glucose requirement, and that this is a harmful side effect of a ketogenic diet. Is that a fair representation of?
Yeah. It's an essential to making the ketones. The ketones are great if you get them in fruits and potatoes, for example. They work fine as an energy source for heart and brain and so on. But if you have to make them yourself, the way you make them is to break down proteins, which will come necessarily partly from your own tissues, despite the fact that you're eating a lot of protein. The cortisol doesn't care whether it's exogenous protein or your muscle protein that it breaks down. And so when you're starving your tissues for glucose, your brain, lungs, and heart are going to get glucose any way it can, which means from protein. And so you break down your own protein or your food protein. And in the process, you have to dispose of the large amount of ammonia released by the protein. That means that you become increasingly dependent on carbon dioxide to combine with the ammonia to make urea and get rid of the potentially toxic ammonia. And if something interferes with your carbon dioxide production, specifically not oxidizing enough glucose, which produces about twice as much CO2 per unit of energy as oxidizing fat, you're creating a situation in which you have these multiple interacting stress factors that generally, at an extreme, it can end up with poisoning your brain with too much ammonia, but always to some extent poisoning your body with too much cortisol breaking down protein to make the glucose to sustain your brain and lungs and blood system.
Right, understood. And that would explain why people who go on a ketogenic weight loss diet seem to experience a little more free fat mass or fat-free mass loss compared to people who go on a high-carb, low-fat diet when they examine the two side by side.
Just looking at the pancreas gland itself, way back around 1920, people were thinking of genetic reasons for the loss of the beta cells in the pancreas that can make insulin. And it turns out that we have stem cells in the pancreas constantly replacing. If you kill, for whatever reason, your beta cells, there are stem cells ready to give birth to new insulin-producing beta cells. And glucose is the sustaining factor for making new stem cells, for maintaining the ability to replace missing insulin-producing cells. But free fatty acids are constantly killing the beta cells. So a deficiency of glucose limits the stem cell production, and an excess of free fatty acids kills the beta cells faster. That means that you can very quickly activate these stem cells to make new beta cells, and at the same time, by increasing the sugar availability, decrease the free fatty acids, which are killing the beta cells. And that can account for how these two 19th century doctors so quickly cured terminal diabetics. The pancreas is perfectly willing to repair itself and become non-diabetic if you just stop killing it with PUFA.
So what about people who do the lower carb diet, but they're eating 40 to 50 carbs, 50 grams of carbs a day? Would that not be enough? That would not be enough?
Far from it, I think. It's somewhat well more than 100 grams per day. The healthy amount seems to be up above 200 grams of carbohydrate per day. The therapeutic amount that the French and English doctors used was somewhat a little over half a pound of sugar per day added to a standard diet.
So what about folks that say they seem to gain weight whenever they're eating that kind of level of sugar, 200 grams of sugar a day? Is it just about the right sugars, eating the fruits?
Well, they probably weren't terminal diabetics. The patients of these 19th century doctors stopped needing the sugar supplement in just 2 or 3 weeks. But if someone isn't diabetic and they add that amount of sugar, it's all unnecessary excess calories. in the case of the diabetics, they were powerfully deficient in calories. And so when they added half a pound of sugar, they were simply making them calorie neutral. Shifted them to an anabolic metabolism that made the calories more efficient for rebuilding muscle. But a person who isn't in that dying state from advanced diabetes always has to attend to keeping their calorie intake within their metabolic consumption. Animal experiments show that shifting to a fruit or sugar-based sucrose-added diet increases, in various studies, increases the metabolic rate by around 20%, so they can keep their metabolism in a calorie balanced condition, even by adding a moderate amount of sugar. But gaining fat weight means definitely that you're out of balance, taking in too many calories.
So if a person who's normal in terms of not having any specific diseases but overweight, you would recommend still including lots of fruits. And I believe you're big on dairy, ice cream, even could people...
Yeah, the calcium and vitamin D are probably the most powerful weight loss nutrients there are, because both of them suppress the inflammatory system and the parathyroid hormone. And the parathyroid hormone suppresses mitochondrial oxidation and creates a vicious circle of stress. And the most powerful way to stop that exaggerated parathyroid hormone is to get a lot of calcium, magnesium, and vitamin D in your diet. And that, again, drastically increases your ability to burn calories, produce heat, and not get fat. A low-fat milk diet with adequate vitamin D is a very efficient weight loss diet, as well as therapeutic in a variety of other conditions. In fact, probably all of the really dangerous diseases are helped by a diet high in vitamin D, calcium, and magnesium.
Interesting.
Yeah. So the you've talked about the vitamin D factor. Would that best source of that be getting a lot of sunlight exposure?
Yeah. In a moderate latitude, in Florida, the sun is always within a reasonable intensity, high in the sky during the middle of the day. In the northern states, except in the late spring, summer, and early fall, even the midday sun is so low in the sky, you're not going to get enough sun. Only in the middle of the day in the summer, late spring and early fall in the northern states, sunbathing is curative. It takes 30 minutes to an hour of good sun exposure on the majority of your skin to keep your vitamin D level at least the middle of the range that they call normal. It should be something like 50 or 60 nanograms per milliliter to keep your parathyroid hormone under control.
And is that now, morning sun the best sun?
In Florida, it's probably the best. You can get very sunburned if you spend too much time in the middle of the day. So you have good ultraviolet activity when you're in a low latitude. And the higher altitude, the sun is more intense.
Dr. Pete, have you looked into the relationship between, it's not something I've seen in your writing, have you looked into the relationship between omega-6 PUFA intake and sunburn and skin cancer?
There was a rabbit experiment that they shaved the rabbits and fed one group a PUFA-rich diet, the other one a PUFA-deficient diet. And the ones on a PUFA-deficient diet didn't have sun damage. And they happened to be studying the wrinkling effect. The ones eating a lot of PUFA had so much sun damage, their skin got fragile and wrinkled. And the same thing that causes wrinkling, it's the same process that leads to chronic inflammation and cancer.
Right, and additionally, I would expect the fibrosis that we see in a lot of these chronic diseases.
The tendency to swelling up, burn symptoms, and eventually fibrosis, and even calcium deposits in extremely damaged skin. It's very common for precancerous and cancerous inflamed cells to show crystals of calcium forming.
Interesting, due to the body's inability to properly process calcium, I presume. Interesting. I discovered myself years back after going to a low omega-6 PUFA diet that I, within a few weeks, had a much lower susceptibility to sunburn. I've also noticed a lower susceptibility to just burn from hot things, like, you know, kitchen accidents and the like. It's been a rather dramatic alteration that a lot of other people have reported when they go on a diet that's also low in omega-6 fats, like a lot of the people who go on a carnivore diet. If they're eating a lot of beef, they're going to get a lot less omega-6, and they've pretty unanimously noticed a decline in susceptibility to sunburn. And
vitamin D and calcium help that along. They are contradictory to the PUFA effect. I used to sunburn just ridiculously easy, just driving with tinted windows in a bright sunny area in the desert, for example. I would get horribly sunburned right through the windows, and 5 minutes in the midday sunlight in Mexico, and I would have a lobster looking skin color. But after supplementing vitamin D, getting lots of milk in my diet, and avoiding PUFA as completely as possible, the last time I was in Mexico, I was able to work the whole day at about 7,500 feet altitude, extremely intense ultraviolet, no burning at all.
Wow.
Right. I've noticed similar myself. I now live in Idaho in the high desert, and I'm not impervious to sunburn, but I can go hours without getting a serious burn. It's quite pleasant not having to worry about that.
Very, very convenient. I used to wear a hat all the time, but I don't bother with a hat anymore.
You talk about milk consumption. A lot of people are concerned about drinking store-bought pasteurized milk. They feel like there's all kinds of stuff in there that ruins the quality of the product that you would get in raw milk. Do you have any thoughts on that?
The pasteurizing does slightly lower the vitamin content and so on. So it's still just about the best food available, even when it's not well treated. But if you have a problem with one brand of milk, I found that the taste of the milk is a good indicator of how easy it is on your digestion. Some people do react probably to the way they've added the vitamin A and D. They use an emulsifier, and some of the emulsifiers might cause digestive problems. But if you try different brands, you can usually find some kind of milk that agrees with your digestive system. And if you haven't been a milk drinker, it's important to start with, for example, half a glass with each meal, and then gradually build up over a few weeks, because it takes time to induce enzymes such as lactase in your intestine. Even lactose intolerant people, if they go at it gradually, can induce the enzymes needed to break down lactose.
So you don't seek out raw milk yourself? You don't drink that?
No. If I had a good, clean source, a lot of even commercial dairies don't wash the udders of the cow before they milk it. When we had a cow at home, we always carefully sponged off the udder to get rid of the dandruff and any dirt that might be possible to get into the milk. But lots of dairies don't do proper hygiene with their cows.
Should children drink low-fat milk or full-fat milk?
What kind of children?
Just children growing up. Should they drink full-fat or low-fat?
It depends on how active they are. Nowadays, kids are more likely to be watching their computer or telephones than doing active calorie burning. So I think usually 1 or 2% fat content is good even for kids. In a dairy country where people are working vigorously 8 or 10 hours a day, then full-fat milk is very appropriate because they need the calories and will burn them. Very often people who drink whole milk and have a sedentary way of life are going to get fat.
Right. I mean, although there's, you know, have you seen Herman Ponser's papers on exercise and obesity?
Who is that?
Herman Ponser, Pontzer. He's a...
No, I haven't seen them.
They're pretty interesting. I mean, that's a little off topic, but I highly commend his work. It's quite interesting looking at the relationship between exercise and obesity.
One of the overlooked things that exercise does, if you're working, for example, you don't have to think of exercising if you're moving bales of hay or milking a cow or whatever. But one of the overlooked things is that muscle activity increases your body temperature, and the increased body temperature increases your calorie burning ability. And so it's similar to what thyroid supplementing does. The good body warming effect of physical activity keeps your metabolic rate going with an anti-inflammatory effect. If you're sedentary, your body's temperature falls and you go into a pro-inflammatory state.
Well, of course, exercise also upregulates your resistance to oxidative stress, which, from my understanding of that term, is generally what it means in practice is a toxic effect of omega-6 fat breakdown. And exercise increases your ability to detoxify omega-6 fats in the body and their metabolites.
Yeah, and increased body temperature is a very powerful effect in reducing lipid peroxidation, for example. Higher body temperature lowers inflammation and lowers lipid peroxidation, makes you oxidize properly rather than oxidizing fats that shouldn't be oxidized.
Right. Now, so that gets another controversial position that you hold, and I will, you know, with the caveat that assuming I understand it correctly, let me describe what I understand, is that you caution people against excess fish oil intake. Clearly, omega-3 fats are also susceptible to lipid peroxidation, just like omega-6 fats are.
Much more so.
Much more so, okay. Although, so do you want to describe your position on that so I don't mangle it?
It's the number of double bonds, and the fish oil is extremely rich in 5 and 6 double bonds, where the seed oil N-3, N-6 vegetable oils typically have 2 or 3 double bonds. Those are sufficiently toxic. But when you get 5 or 6 double bonds in a molecule, the instability is that much greater. The anti-thyroid effect of the fish oil, very highly unsaturated, is that much greater than the seed oil. But the good thing is that they are so unstable that a large part of them breaks down before they even circulate to your tissues. And it's the breakdown products, the oxidation fragments of the N-3 fish oil type of PUFA that has the so-called anti-inflammatory effect. It's toxic to your immune system to the extent that for the first few months you can see a definite anti-inflammatory effect by interfering with things such as prostaglandin synthesis and some of the inflammatory cytokines and breaking down thymus cells that could be involved in inflammation. But the trouble is that prolonged use, after about 6 months, this anti-inflammatory effect starts becoming immunosuppressive. Over a lifetime, the amount of the long chain, highly unsaturated N-3, accumulates, stabilized to some extent by forming an ester with cholesterol molecules. Uh-huh. And that happens in atherosclerotic plaques in the arteries. When it does oxidize, forming age pigment-like material in your arteries, that's part of the buildup of the high cholesterol-containing plaque. But it's the PUFA esters that start the process of forming age pigment and or arterial plaques. But that process continues in the brain, so that the old person's brain has much more fish oil-like molecules. The baby's brain, any healthy pregnancy, delivers a baby who is, according to the dietitians, deficient in the so-called essential fatty acids. Their brain, their body is burning calories at two or three times the rate of an older individual, and their brain is learning at a several times higher rate than an adult.
Right.
In the teens, the metabolic rate slows drastically in proportion to how much unsaturated fat is in your diet, turning down your metabolic rate. But with aging, these anti-metabolic fish oil-like N-3 fats build up steadily in the brain. People are talking about them as being necessary because they find so much of them in the brain. But in a late development fetus, just before delivery and right after delivery, healthy babies are extremely deficient in all of the PUFA. And the brain function corresponds negatively to the amount of PUFA esters of cholesterol in the brain. So the actual available cholesterol decreases in the aging and dementing brain. The cholesterol which is needed to make progesterone in the brain, for example, is bound up to the PUFA molecules, which accumulate. The demented brain has more total cholesterol, but it's inactivated by being stuck to the highly unsaturated molecules that have accumulated from the diet.
From what I understand, babies are more naturally going in and out of ketosis. Is that a healthy version because they're getting the ketones from the mother's milk? Or
the mother's milk is.
So because they're not producing those ketones in their own body, it's a healthy type of ketosis for them to have.
Well, I don't think they should go into ketosis if the mother is producing sugar-rich milk. The baby has such a high metabolic rate, they very quickly use up their sugar and need to be fed again.
Right. Okay. So let's distinguish though between fish oil and fish consumption. I mean, I've read some of your posts where you recommend eating some amount of fish, but not necessarily the fatty fish like salmon and mackerel and sardines that we're all told are the healthiest fish because of the high omega-6 content. And I mean, you mentioned at the beginning of this discussion, Mexicans eating crustaceans and having a healthy diet. And of course, the Japanese eat a lot of fish and have a fairly healthy lifespan.
And what the crustacean eats, the PUFA derive generally from algae, and the very simple sea creatures or water or organisms live ultimately from the nature of the simple single cellular sun dependent organisms. So if the food that the crustacean eats has a more saturated fat because they live at a warmer temperature, then the crustacean itself is going to have less of the fish oil material. For example, in the Amazon with a high water temperature, 85 degrees or so, the fish fat there is closer to butter than to what we think of as fish oil from the northern seas that are very cold.
Of course, and the same effect holds true for vegetable fats that coconuts and palm, which come from tropical areas, are much more saturated than grains, which tend to grow in temperate climates.
And you can show that effect. If someone put sweaters on pigs, for example, and showed that their fat was more saturated.
That's very funny. Interesting. Now, sorry, David, go ahead.
But I just wanted to ask about some other things to avoid PUFA. Should people avoid the chicken eggs from the grocery store, pork, fatty chicken, because they have a lot of high linoleic acid in the fat?
Right. When I make chicken broth, I let it cool enough to skim off as much of the fat as possible. Someone sent me some of their pork. They had the fat analyzed where the agriculture department found that their so-called saturated fat from lard was actually over 30% PUFA. But this pork producer sent me a sample of their foods, their bacon and such, that by analysis had only 4% PUFA, and butter is from 2 to 3% PUFA. So that pork would be very safe. And if you feed your chickens or your pigs a good diet, like my friends in Mexico feed their chickens table scraps, lots of tortillas, carbohydrates, and let them eat bugs that are relatively saturated, their eggs taste much better
yes.
and are low in PUFA. The worse the supermarket egg tastes, if they give them flax, for example, the eggs will taste like fish because of the highly unsaturated fats.
Right. Yeah, I noticed I traveled down to Ecuador many years ago, and the first thing that I ate when I got there was a plate of scrambled eggs, and I was absolutely blown away by how much better they tasted than American eggs. And they, you know, the yolks were dark orange, and it just, you know, I've never forgotten how much tastier those eggs were. I've been trying to recapture that experience here in America, and it's not very easy, even with pastured eggs, because they do feed them a lot of grain as a base diet.
If you keep them close to the house so they eat the food you are throwing away, they're getting almost a good diet.
Right. Now, something else that you just mentioned, how babies seem to be born in a state that a medical doctor would describe as almost essential fatty acid deficient. Mm-hmm. There's a fascinating paper that I came across. Of course, as I'm sure you're aware, that one of the quote-unquote signs of essential fatty acid deficiency is the presence of meat acid, which is an omega-9 fatty acid made by the body in the absence of omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids. And this paper looked at the cartilage of a variety of different species and noticed that every single animal that they looked at when it was born had a high amount of meat acid in the cartilage, indicating that it was essentially that it was deficient. But also the fact that every single one of them was born in that state indicates that that may be the state that we ought to be in. What do you think of that that point of view?
Absolutely right. There's a guy in Australia, I think his name was Clellan, found a way to get a practical amount to make supplements of an omega minus 9 equivalent of a prostaglandin. Our bodies, when we're deficient in PUFA, will still use the enzymes that makes the big prostaglandins, but they will act on the omega-9 fats, producing a prostaglandin-like material, except these are anti-inflammatory and restorative, regenerative, where the prostaglandins we know made from N-6 fatty acids are invariably harmful. Even the so-called good prostaglandins have their harmful side effects, breaking down bone structure, damaging nerve cells, skin cells, blood vessels, everything the prostaglandins we're familiar with all have their very harmful effects. But the omega minus 9 based prostaglandin like substances are actually essential and beneficial to good health. But you have to be deficient in the so-called essential fatty acids before we produce enough of the meat acids to reliably make these anti-inflammatory protective prostanoids.
Interesting.
And animal experiments, I've accumulated about 20 of them, I guess, showing that any injury to the animal is minimal when the animal is producing meat acids and deficient in the so-called essential fatty acids.
Now, what do you mean by any injury to the animal is minimal?
They took some of them by the tail and whacked them against the furniture. And gave others cobra venom, all kinds of toxins that they could think of, poisons that would create diabetes in other animals, didn't hurt these deficient animals.
Mm. See, now that is again fascinating, because one of the things, and I've posted about this on Twitter a number of times, that I have noticed since going on a low omega-6 diet is that I am much more resistant to injury, and especially to pain from injury. And at first it was so extreme that I was concerned that I was coming down with leprosy, of course, the primary symptom of which is peripheral nerve degeneration to the point where you can't feel things. But, you know, 10 years later, it's still going on, and I'm, you know, obviously don't have leprosy, but am still largely impervious to these little minor impacts. I've never heard of animal studies actually showing that. That's quite fascinating.
The prostaglandins, the corresponding accumulation that's generally related to age, as you eat the standard diets, the prostaglandins are easier and more abundant to produce with a minor injury the older you are, and the more of these unsaturated fats you have in your tissues. And so an old person injuring their tissues gets worse symptoms. A very healthy, say a 3 or 4 year old can get a bruise or a scrape or a cut, and in 3 or 4 days there's no sign of it left. Or an old person will sometimes develop a chronic problem, or at best it might take 2 weeks to heal an equivalent injury.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly what I've noticed. I heal much more quickly. I'm much more, you know, impervious to pain. I had a coal recently fly out of a campfire and land on my leg, and it hurt a lot when it was sitting on my leg, burning me and burning a hole through my pants. As soon as I took it off, the pain went away. And, you know, previously I would have expected a burn to hurt for days. And now the pain went away as soon as I had the source of the burning off my body. And it just blew my mind what a stark difference it was from my previous experiences.
Hans Selye, who was famous for the stress physiology, he carried his stress studies from the systemic level down to the tissue level and found that such things as polyunsaturated fats caused all sorts of susceptibility. Canola oil, he found that it was the PUFA content of the original rapeseed oil rather than the erucic acid that was eliminated to make canola. He found that just the linoleic acid content of the natural rapeseed oil was enough to spontaneously cause necrotic areas to form in the heart, spontaneous heart degeneration. But he found that on the same amount of rapeseed oil, if he added cocoa butter with a very high stearic acid content, their heart was protected by displacing the harmful so-called essential fatty acids. And other studies of his showed that vitamin E, which prevents the breakdown of polyunsaturated fats, protected against all of the consequences, starting with histamine release from any kind of injury you can think of. In some experiments, you would pull tufts of an animal's hair out. That was enough to activate histamine and other stress signals that would then be amplified by prostaglandins from their PUFA in the tissues, leading to calcification defensively and in the absence of vitamin E, the PUFA prostaglandin histamine interactions would cause iron deposition and a scleroderma-like condition. He showed that an iron excess and vitamin E deficiency activating the PUFA oxidation created rats that were like an armadillo. You could tap them with a pencil and it sounded like they had a shell. Their skin was so calcified.
Well, okay, that doesn't sound great. That certainly doesn't sound great. That is very interesting. Have you heard of the term ferroptosis?
In fact, that's part of the current newsletter I mean to write in the next few days, is how that concept really is an extension of what Hans Selye was working on. He would inject iron chloride, for example, and create a predisposition to tissue injury, cell death, inflammation, calcification, fibrosis, and so on.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, ferroptosis to me sounds like a description of how iron catalyzes PUFA oxidation. And I think blaming it on the iron is a bit misleading.
I think Hans Selye was on the right course 60 years ago.
Dr. Pete, how does one subscribe to your newsletter? And I ask you this because I would like to. And I'm sure a lot of our interest, our listeners would be interested in doing so as well.
Yeah, the email address is repeatnewsletter with the S but no apostrophe at gmail.com.
At email or Gmail?
At gmail.com.
Gmail.com. Mm-hmm.
And just send an email asking to be subscribed?
It costs $20 for 12 issues over 2 years, bimonthly.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you quickly, we recently interviewed Professor Bruce Hammack of UC Davis, who's been studying linoleic acid. He was first looking at burn patients and how they were affected by their high amounts of linoleic acid in their body. And how their infections were correlated to that. And then
he discovered the soluble epoxide hydrolase enzyme. Go ahead, David. Sorry.
And he recently published a paper in Frontiers in Physiology describing that they were examining severe COVID patients who had this ARDS disease. And he said the majority of them were all, you know, every one of the ones they looked at had this high amount of leukotoxin from linoleic acid that was causing the acute respiratory distress syndrome. Is that similar to what you would suggest is causing a lot of this recurring severe cases for this pandemic?
Yeah, the iron and PUFA are exactly part of any stress reaction of viral inflammatory thrombotic diseases. It's all the sort of thing that Hans Selye was exploring in the 1960s.
So iron is just as problematic as PUFA as a stressor, or am I?
Well, they go together. When your energy production slows down because of PUFA, the tissue has many reactions, so that a defensive reaction to any sort of injury or infection increases the heme oxygenase production, an potentially antioxidant process, but the heme oxygenase breaks down heme, depositing iron in the tissue as well as carbon monoxide, further slowing down mitochondrial energy production while the iron accumulates. So the more iron that's available, the lower the energy production in reaction to injury or infection, the worse the outcome is going to be. So iron chelators, for example, can be therapeutic in some situations, but just reducing the amount of iron in your diet and milk and cheese as major factors in the diet are going to protect you very quickly against the retained iron excess, make you less susceptible to degenerative injury, ferroptosis, inflammation, and so on from any stressor, including viruses.
So should you reduce your red meat consumption, even if you've gotten rid of your PUFA consumption, you know, reduce your seed oil consumption completely?
The meat not only has a very out of balance iron excess relative to copper and other minerals, it also has an imbalance in the direction of tryptophan and cysteine, which are anti-thyroid pro-inflammatory amino acids, and an extremely out of balance excess of phosphate, which is an excitatory agent, counteracting the protective quieting effects of calcium.
Some have suggested that the that these high amounts of PUFA consumption are creating and are inducing a state of torpor in humans, and that's why there's a constant low energy state and a desire, you know, to overeat and be lethargic and to almost get ready for hibernation almost.
Temperature is lowered. Animals that are going to hibernate load up on seeds, for example, in the late summer and early fall. They tremendously increase their PUFA content and shift. That brings up serotonin activity, which helps to lower the body temperature.
Interesting. So you do believe that the high PUFA consumption probably is inducing a kind of torpid state for people or humans?
The experimenters have deprived them of PUFA, and they didn't go into torpor or hibernation.
Animal models.
Interesting. So that's interesting to consider that as what's going on here then.
Well, there's also a human experiment. I mean, an N=1, where a woman who was on a low omega-6 diet started eating omega-6, and her metabolic rate went down pretty promptly. That was done with
about 50 years ago. Someone did a very illuminating rat experiment. They divided, I think it was 15 different diet compositions with either high and low PUFA content and either high or low saturated fat content and intermediate diets to all of those. And at the end of a long period, most of their life, they analyzed their body composition and found that the highest body fat corresponded to the proportion of PUFA in the diet, not the quantity, and was lowest in the diets with the proportion of saturated fats, not the quantity, so that the high saturated fat diets produced leaner animals ultimately than a low PUFA diet. It was the proportion, not the quantity. That illustrates the slowing of the metabolic rate.
So that's the PS ratio, the polyunsaturated to saturated ratio that Ansel Keys suggested having a high PS ratio would protect you from heart disease. And when that was tested experimentally in humans in the Lyon diet heart study, they found a massive decrease in subsequent cardiovascular events in the people with the low PS ratio. It sounds like that may be a more fundamental indicator of health than just the effects on obesity.
The saturation index, the opposite of the PS ratio, high saturated proportion, corresponds to species that are naturally longer lived. They are naturally more saturated. The cancer-prone individuals are low saturation index. They are more highly polyunsaturated if they're likely to get cancer.
Interesting.
A researcher named Brad Marshall went and researched the USDA data for food consumption, caloric consumption for Americans in 1938. He looked at different groups, and he found that the average caloric intake for a unit for a human was like over 4,000 calories a day in 1938. And everybody was, you know, relatively thin, and they weren't eating the PUFA like we are today. Do you believe that they were eating higher amounts of calories on average in those days than they are than we are today?
Oh yeah. Even in the 1930s, Broda Barnes, studying different populations, found that there was a fairly significant part of the population that was hypothyroid, but that proportion has drastically increased during the time that we've been promoting unsaturated seed oils as a major so-called essential fatty acid source. And when you look at the amount of grains in the diet and things that are sources of unsaturated fats versus fruits, for example, that help us make the saturated fats, the obesity of the population corresponds to these starches and PUFA in the diet, not the sugar.
Interesting. Even table sugar?
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, even table sugar doesn't have a connection?
The same thing that the diabetes doctors 150 years ago found. The even table sugar supports our metabolic calorie burning better than a grain-based starchy diet.
Interesting. So, Dr. Pete, what's the takeaway for people? What would you, of the things we've discussed and of obviously the larger body of work that you've put together, what would you say are the most important alterations one ought to make in one's diet to achieve a more optimal health?
More fruit and milk would be the key simple things, and sunlight, definitely avoiding all of the added PUFA. Everything you buy in the supermarket is somehow distorted. They're even trying to put PUFA in the milk by feeding chemical mixtures to cows that prevent the protective saturation that the rumen does.
What about olive oil? You hear a lot of people wanting olive oil as a healthy thing.
If it's actually good tasting, first pressing olive oil. What the one you don't want is what they call light olive oil. It has a much higher PUFA content, but a good first pressing olive oil is only 8 or 10% PUFA usually.
Very good.
Right.
Well, this is all has been very fascinating, Dr. Pete. We really appreciate everything you've shared with us.
Yes, great as always. Great cause for thought and further research.
Yeah, thank you for your time. And can you give out that email again for those who want to subscribe to your newsletter?
Ray Pete's newsletter at gmail.com, $28 for 12 issues over 2 years.
Okay, and just to be perfectly clear, that's because I've already tried to send an email to it and mistyped the email address and got a correction sent back to me. It's RayPeats newsletter. If you leave the S out, somebody will send you back an automatic correction.
That's good. They correct it.
I suppose whoever it is has gotten a lot of these. But at any rate, thank you, Dr. Pete. This has been very educational. I've got screenfuls of open references from our conversation, and it's going to take a little while to process all of this stuff, but it's been really quite enlightening.
Good talking to you.
Yeah, you too. Take care.
Have a great day.
Bye. Thank you.